CRJ225, this is our week two podcast. And in week two, we're going to begin with an assignment that looks into infancy, insanity, intoxication, and negligence as defenses to a criminal charge. So 720 ILCS 5/6, or Article 6, is entitled Responsibility. It infers that the focus is on whether the defendant has the capacity to be responsible for his or her actions. Article 6 goes on to break down infancy, intoxication, and insanity as defenses that may be raised by the defendant as to why they should not be held responsible for their actions. So 6.1 deals with infancy. And, you know, it might be helpful if you have the document that I provided that sort of breaks this down and leads you to the statute, but also sometimes it's helpful to open up the statute. But this section provides that no person shall be convicted of any offense unless he had attained his 13th birthday at the time the offense was committed. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time here because many of you will take juvenile delinquency, or you could. Suffice it to say, we see this defense debated more and more as juveniles and even very young children commit heinous acts that we typically associate with adults. And then I shared, or I will share a link, a recent case, fairly recent, of a 9-year-old boy who had committed murder. Most of the time, this is a situation that is sorted out in the charging phase with the decision, in most cases, to bring the child through the juvenile justice system. Section 6-3 deals with intoxicated or drugged conditions. And a person who is intoxicated or drugged is criminally responsible for conduct unless that condition is involuntary. So, in other words, they didn't ingest or take or drink. The things that caused them to be intoxicated at the time or drugged at the time of their act. So that's not normally the course of events, right? But the idea is that intoxication deprived the person of substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality of their conduct or to conform their conduct to the requirements of the law. Involuntary intoxication or drug conditions are very rare. And remember, the defendant must prove their defense. So think of some really good facts, witnesses, and proof that the intoxication was not of their free will. So in other words, they were tricked, drugged, whatever, but they didn't choose to drink or take or use the substance. And then you'll note negligence, the failure to take proper care in doing something, is not a defense to a criminal charge. We will get into why this is the case later when we get into the elements and drive home some other factors. Insanity is the next defense. That's in section 6-2. A person is not criminally responsible for conduct if at the time of such conduct as a result of a mental disease or mental defect, they lack the substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of his or her conduct. The terms mental disease or mental defect do not include abnormality manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct. A person who at the time of the commission of a criminal offense was not insane but was suffering from a mental illness is not relieved of criminal responsibility for his or her conduct, and they can be found guilty but mentally ill. Now, for the purposes of this section, mental illness or mentally ill means a substantial disorder of thought, mood, or behavior which afflicted a person at the time of the commission of the offense and which impaired that person's judgment, but not to the extent that he or she is unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of their behavior. When the defense of insanity has been presented during the trial, the burden of proof is on the defendant to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant is not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, clear and convincing evidence. Many of you know this because you've had me for other classes, but if you have not, this is a good time to review our standards of proof, what the standard is. For instance, if you're thinking in how a judge or a jury is bound to decide or weigh the evidence, and think of it in terms of weighing. You may be familiar with the scales of justice. The symbolism of that is this, and let me have you demonstrate. So I may make you feel a little weird right now, but I want you to hold your hands out to your sides, palms up. Have them even. Start out with your palms up at your shoulders, just hands pointing straight out to your right and to your left, away from your body. That's the scales of justice. Now, for criminal cases, the burden of proof is typically beyond a reasonable doubt. So if you drop your right hand all the way down to your waist and your left hand above your head, that's beyond a reasonable doubt. That scale has tipped all the way, one way or another. Either it's, you know, got to be all the way down for guilty, okay? In most civil cases, it's preponderance of the evidence, so return your hands to shoulder level. That scale just has to tip a little bit. So just bring your right hand up a little bit above your shoulder and your left hand down a little below your shoulder. That's preponderance of the evidence. Clear and convincing is somewhere in the middle. Okay, clear and convincing is not all the way to beyond a reasonable doubt. So if you tip your scales, move your hands up or down, you know, slightly above, but not all the way above, that's what we're talking about with clear and convincing. Part of your assignment this week involves reading and summarizing an Illinois case in which the defendant attempted to raise the defense of insanity. Really spend some time reading the court's presentation of that process, the various stages, and all that goes into the review, analysis, and gathering evidence regarding an insanity defense. Read the spectrum of examples that your fellow students will present, because each of you is presenting a different example. It'll give you an opportunity to expand your knowledge on how these defenses may be raised. And remember, these are defenses raised by the defendant. They have the burden of proof of on these defenses. Now, the second part of your week, your second assignment for week two, pivots to self-defense and defenses of others and use of force. So, the definition of self-defense. Self-defense is an act of using force that, under different circumstances, would be unlawful. The only reason you use the force was to protect yourself or another person or property from imminent harm. The argument of self-defense is what is known as an affirmative defense. You admit to engaging in certain behavior, but offer the justification for your actions. For the purposes of self-defense, you must simply prove that using force was necessary to thwart an imminent or immediate threat of harm. People have the right to defend themselves when they are attacked or they feel in danger, and this is known as self-defense. Now, every state, including Illinois, has different laws that define what self-defense means. In Illinois, you can use reasonable force. That's what it says, reasonable force, to defend yourself or someone else, or to defend your home or property. The first course of business would be Illinois statutes found at 720 ILCS 5/7-1. In each case, the following conditions must exist to justify use of force. There was an imminent danger or threat to you, someone else, or your property. The threat was unlawful. You believed that a danger existed that required force, and you used force that was, now this is an important one, equal to the threat. You used force that was equal to the threat. You cannot claim self-defense if you were the aggressor. You can only argue self-defense if you are reacting to another person's unlawful conduct and or trying to prevent a felony from being committed. This means that you cannot start a fight and then, when attacked, claim that you were acting in self-defense. You also cannot overreact or act unreasonably in defending yourself. Now, what's proportionate force mean? When acting in self-defense, you will have the right to use the level of force that is necessary to prevent harm. The level of force you use should be proportionate to the threat of harm you face. Using deadly force to defend against a simple assault, for example, would not be proportionate. However, using deadly force to protect yourself or another person may be justified if you fear immediate and substantial bodily harm or death. There are two levels of force under the self-defense laws: regular force, force that prevents someone from moving or acting normally, and deadly force, force that causes or is intended to cause serious bodily harm or death. Now, regular force. You can use regular force to defend yourself or someone else against an attack or entry into a home or any other type of property. Deadly force needs to be expanded out of three scenarios. Defense of a person. If you're defending yourself or someone else, you can use deadly force if you reasonably believe it is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to yourself or another person, or a forced felony such as sexual assault, battery, murder, robbery, arson. Forcible felonies are defined in Illinois under 720 ILCS 5/2-8, and they include murder, predatory criminal sexual assault of a child, criminal sexual assault, robbery, burglary, kidnapping, arson, aggravated battery, and any felony involving the use or threat of physical force or violence. Now, defense of a home. You can use deadly force to prevent an assault or threat of violence against yourself or someone else in a home or other building, but only if you use it against someone who is trying to enter in a violent manner, or you reasonably believe that such force is necessary to prevent a forcible felony in the building. Deadly force is generally not allowed to be used when you are protecting your own personal property or real property. You can use deadly force, however, only if you reasonably believe that such force is necessary to prevent the commission of a forcible felony. Go back to what I just said a little while ago about forcible felonies and what those are. It's kind of in this area that people always want to talk about stand your ground. In Illinois, you do not have a duty to retreat before using force. You do not have a duty to retreat before using force to defend yourself from danger. While there is no explicit language in the state's criminal code, state courts have expressed that there is no requirement to escape danger before resorting to force. However, Illinois uses a similar doctrine to stand your ground called the Castle Doctrine. Both stand your ground and the Castle Doctrine jurisdictions differ from duty to retreat states because they do not require an individual to first retreat from the danger before using force against an attacker. However, the Castle Doctrine gives people the right to avoid retreating in their home in order to protect themselves from intruders. The intent of the law is that your home is equivalent to your castle. And as king or queen of your castle, you should not be required to retreat from people who have no right to be in your home. The Castle Doctrine has limits as contrasted to stand your ground laws that have no such limit. It's limited to the home, the area of the home, inside the home. So in other words, you can't chase somebody off your sidewalk. It's not in your home. Those are the defenses that we are going to review this week. We start getting into the crimes next week, rolling with solicitation and conspiracy in the first part of our assignments. I hope week one was well and good for you. I hope week two is even better. We get through this week, we're a quarter of the way through the summer. So keep your focus, use your calendars, stay disciplined. Be sure that you do the work for yourself and be sure that you also log in and read what your fellow students have written. That's part of this whole exercise, to have that breadth and spectrum of the different things and examples of all we talk about in this course.